You're listening to ESL Podcast English Cafe, number 540. English as a Second Language Podcast, English Cafe, episode 540. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff McQuillan, coming to you from the Center for Educational Development in beautiful Los Angeles, California. Visit our website at eslpod.com. Download this episode's learning guide, an 8-to-10-page guide we provide for all of our current episodes that gives you some additional help in improving your English, including a complete transcript of everything I say. You can also take a look at our ESL podcast store with additional courses in English and our ESL podcast blog. On this cafe, we're going to talk about the 1968 movie, Planet of the Apes. We're also going to talk about one of the shortest presidencies in U.S. history, that of Zachary Taylor. And as always, we'll answer a few of your questions. Let's get started. The 1968 movie, Planet of the Apes, tells a very unusual story, a story of what we may call an alternate world. Alternate, A-L-T-E-R-N-A-T-E, means something that is similar to something else, but different in a noticeable or an important way. We use alternate as an adjective to describe another way of doing something or another kind of thing that you could use in place of something else. So when you're driving, we may talk about an alternate route, R-O-U-T-E, a route as a way of getting from one place to another. Here in Los Angeles, it's necessary to know alternate routes, different ways of getting from one place to another, because we have so much traffic, so many cars, and so you need to know other ways of getting to the places you want to go to. Here we're talking about an alternate world, a whole world, a whole reality, if you will, that's different from our own. Planet of the Apes, then, is a kind of science fiction movie. An ape, A-P-E, is an animal similar to a monkey, but it doesn't have a tail. My neighbor, for example, looks a little like an ape. In the movie Planet of the Apes, the alternate world is one in which apes act like human beings. They speak, they read, they write, they have jobs. They even have pets and slaves. The interesting thing about the movie is that the pets and slaves in the alternate world are human beings. The movie begins by telling the story of a group of astronauts that leave the planet Earth and go out into outer space. An astronaut is someone who travels outside of the Earth's atmosphere, out into what we call outer space, all that area outside of our own planet. Remember, the movie was released in 1968 when the U.S. had a very active space program. So there were lots of stories and movies about outer space, and this was one of them. In the movie, these astronauts go out into outer space, and their captain is George Taylor, played by the famous American actor Charlton Heston. There's a problem with their spaceship, and the astronauts crash onto a planet that they don't recognize, that isn't familiar to them. To crash, C-R-A-S-H, means that you hit something very hard, you hit something with great force in a violent way. If you crash your car, you hit your car against something else, perhaps another car. Well, these astronauts are on this strange planet, and they, soon after they crash, are captured by these apes. To capture, C-A-P-T-U-R-E, means to take control or possession of someone. The inhabitants of this planet, as I mentioned previously, are apes. An inhabitant, I-N-H-A-B-I-T-A-N-T, is someone who lives in a certain place. The astronauts are prisoners, and they decide, after being captured by these apes, that they should escape. To escape, E-S-C-A-P-E, means to run away from the place where you are now, a place where you are being held, often as a prisoner, as someone who cannot leave. Now, immediately, Taylor and the other astronauts realize what a weird place this is. I mean, there are apes who are talking and holding them as prisoners. The first thing that Charlton Heston's character discovers is that the other humans don't speak. They don't read. They don't seem to be able to communicate with him. Well, very soon, George Taylor, this astronaut, is basically by himself in terms of trying to escape. And the movie follows his attempts to understand these apes and for the apes to understand George Taylor, to understand this human being who speaks. The movie was popular because it tells the exciting story of this man who is trying to understand this strange world in which he finds himself, and of course, trying to get his freedom. Part of the reason the movie was successful also is because of the special effects that were used in the movie. Special effects are images that are created for movies and television programs that make it seem as though the actors are in a different place, in a different time. Another thing that made the movie popular was that the apes were very interesting characters. They were, of course, human beings, not real apes, dressed up as apes, but they used a lot of prosthetics to make the actors look like apes. A prosthetic, P-R-O-S-T-H-E-T-I-C, is a material that covers your body to make you either look like someone different or to replace a body part that you don't have. If you lose your arm or lose your leg, you might get a prosthetic. We might also call it an artificial arm or an artificial leg. The general term would be an artificial limb, L-I-M-B. Notice the B is not pronounced. Your arms and your legs are your limbs. Two of the lead actors in the movies who played apes were Rodney McDowell, the British actor, and Kim Hunter. The prosthetics were so good that the man who created them won an Academy Award for his work. The story of the movie was actually taken from a French novel written in 1963. The original novel tells a similar story, but the theme of the novel was how technology could actually make human beings dumber, and that if we didn't use it properly, our intelligence could be lost. That's what seems to have happened to the humans in this world of Planet of the Apes. When the movie was made, however, the theme or the message of the movie changed somewhat. The person who wrote the script for the movie changed one of the main themes of the movie and made it instead into something related to nuclear war and the ability to have the planet destroyed by nuclear weapons. The person who wrote the script for Planet of the Apes was already famous for writing stories that had some sort of political or social commentary. His name was Rod Serling. Rod Serling had created a television series that you can still see on some American television stations today. It was called The Twilight Zone. Rod Serling then took the message of the movie and changed it somewhat, perhaps reflecting the fears of the American public during this time of the 1960s. The movie became less of a commentary on how technology could make us stupid, a message which is still perhaps one we need to listen to today, but rather on the dangers of nuclear weapons. Although no one considers Planet of the Apes to be one of the great classics of American cinema, of American film, it was a popular movie. It was shown on television quite a bit when I was growing up in the middle and late 1970s. So popular that they made several more movies. In 1970, just 2 years later, they made Beneath the Planet of the Apes. Then they made Escape from the Planet of the Apes in 1971. In 1972, they made Conquest of the Planet of the Apes. And in 1973, Battle for the Planet of the Apes. So it was what we would today call a very successful movie franchise. F-R-A-N-C-H-I-S-E. A movie franchise would be something like Star Wars or the Star Trek movies, the Harry Potter movies, the X-Men movies. When you have several movies based on an original movie or idea or even set of characters. Planet of the Apes was a successful movie franchise. It was also briefly a television show in 1974. In 2001, Tim Burton, the director, made a new Planet of the Apes, although I don't think it was very good. In fact, none of the other movies after the original movie were very good, although they did make money. My favorite is still the original Planet of the Apes with the great Charlton Heston. We turn now to President Zachary Taylor, one of the shortest serving presidents in U.S. history, but a man of considerable accomplishments before reaching the White House. Zachary Taylor was born in 1784 in Virginia on the eastern coast of the United States. Virginia was one of the original 13 states of the U.S. When he was a child, he and his eight brothers and sisters moved to Kentucky. Now, at this time, Kentucky was considered part of what we call the frontier. The frontier, F-R-O-N-T-I-E-R, is an area that is farthest away from the cities and towns where most people live. Kentucky was definitely on the frontier and was a difficult place to live because there weren't very many people there. You had to know how to hunt and fish and survive. When Taylor was 18 years old, he joined the army and would spend most of his life as a military man. He got married to a woman named Margaret Smith, and together they had six children. Interestingly enough, one of his six children, would later marry another man famous in American history, Jefferson Davis. Jefferson Davis was later to become the president of the Confederacy, the group of states that separated themselves from the United States and caused our Civil War. Taylor was good at what he did in the Army, and he was promoted several times, eventually becoming one of the highest members of the U.S. military, the highest ranking members, we would call them, a major general. To be promoted, P-R-O-M-O-T-E, means to be given a more important job, a more powerful job. Taylor served as a leader in several wars during the early part of the 19th century, including the War of 1812. He also served as a leader in some of the wars against the Native American peoples, the Native American tribes. But it was his leadership in the U.S. Army during the Mexican-American War that made him famous throughout the United States. That war with Mexico, which lasted from 1846 to 1848, started in part because of the now state of Texas joining the United States. During the war, the president at that time, President Polk, sent Taylor to the border, the dividing line between Texas and Mexico, and later sent him into the country of Mexico near the city of Monterrey. Taylor didn't particularly like President Polk and didn't actually obey some of his orders. He didn't follow what the president told him to do. In fact, he took a small group of soldiers farther south into Mexico and fought the Mexican army at something called the Battle of Buena Vista. Against all odds, he won that battle, despite having fewer soldiers than the Mexican army had. The expression to win something against all odds, O-D-D-S, means to do something even though it doesn't seem probable that you will, in fact, succeed or be successful. The victories of Polk in the Mexican-American War made him famous, made him what we would call a war hero, and not surprisingly, as has happened in other periods of American history, war heroes, famous generals, are often then asked to become political leaders, and that's what happened to Taylor. The Whig Party asked Taylor to be their nominee for president in the election of 1848, and Taylor won that election, becoming president. The biggest political issue that Taylor had, which was the political issue that all presidents had during the early and mid-19th centuries in the U.S., was that of slavery, of the owning of other human beings. This was a practice that was allowed in some states, the southern states, but not in the northern states. Taylor was against slavery, and one of the first things he did as president was encourage the then territory of California to become a state, which it did in 1849. However, it became a free state when it entered the Union, when it became part of the United States, and this didn't make the slave states, the southern states, very happy, since California would be adding two more senators to the United States Senate. The southern states wanted some sort of compromise so that any future territories and states that were added to the U.S. would not change the political balance of power, we might call it, in the U.S. government. A balance of power refers to how much power two or more different, in this case, political parties have. This ended up being called the Compromise of 1850. Taylor did not live long enough, however, to be able to solve this political issue. On July 4th, 1850, he began to feel very sick. His stomach hurt. He got very ill very quickly. The doctors determined that he had what was not an uncommon disease in the U.S. at that time, cholera. Only 5 days later, on July 9th, 1850, Taylor died in the White House. He had served as president only 16 months. He was the second president to die as president. The first was William Henry Harrison, who wasn't even president a year before he died. There's not a lot else to say about the presidency of poor Zachary Taylor, since he wasn't president for very long. His vice president, Millard Fillmore, became president after he left office, and he wasn't very successful either in solving the problem of slavery in the U.S., a problem that was ultimately solved by the Civil War. If Americans know anything about Zachary Taylor, it's probably more because of his service as a general than his service as our 12th president. One other interesting note, the man that Taylor beat to become president in 1848, the Democrat by the name of Lewis Cass, is a name that is probably familiar in some way to those of us who grew up in the Midwestern part of the U.S. Lewis Cass, before he became a candidate for president, was the governor of the Michigan Territory. He was also Secretary of War under Andrew Jackson and a member of the U.S. Senate. There are several places that are named after Cass, including Cass County in my home state of Minnesota. And there are things named after President Taylor there, I'm sure, as well. Taylor Swift, for example, was named after President Taylor. Maybe. I could be wrong about that. Although I'd like to think I'm never, never, never wrong about anything. Now let's answer some of the questions you have sent to us. Our first question comes from Renee, R-E-N-E, in Mexico. Renee wants to know the meaning of three verbs, to improve, to boost, and to enhance. To improve, I-M-P-R-O-V-E, is a very common verb in English, meaning to make things better or to become better. You can improve your life. You can make it better. You can improve your health by eating better food. You could improve your test scores by studying more instead of playing so many video games. And yes, I'm talking to you, student, who isn't studying out there. To boost, B-O-O-S-T, means to increase the force, power, or amount of something. It's not quite as common of a verb, though it might sometimes be used in the same situations. You could talk about boosting your test scores, for example, meaning improving them, making them higher. You could boost the power to your engine by perhaps giving it more gasoline. The engine or motor in your car, for example. Some people take vitamins for their body to boost their immune system, their ability to heal from diseases and illnesses. There's something related to this verb called a booster chair, and that's a little chair that a young child sits in, often in a restaurant. The restaurant, of course, has chairs for adults, and because the child is too small, the child may not be able to eat at the same table. So they give the child this little chair that the child sits in called a booster chair. You can see the relationship then between to boost and the booster chair is, well, raising up the child so that he can eat. The third verb is to enhance, E-N-H-A-N-C-E. This verb can be used in a lot of different situations. It means, again, to improve something and also to increase something. Usually it's used to mean to improve the value or quality of something. I'm going to enhance the flavor of this food by adding some salt. I'm going to improve it. I'm going to make it better. We also use the verb enhance in photography when we take a picture and make it better or try to make it better by using certain computer effects on it, maybe increasing the light or changing the contrast. These are ways of enhancing a photograph. The noun related to this verb is enhancement, or at least one of the nouns related to this verb. Enhancement refers to a general improvement of some situation. Andre, A-N-D-R-E, from Brazil, wants to know the meaning of two phrases that he's heard or read. The man grows on you, and his bark is worse than his bite. The expression to grow on someone means for you first not to like someone, but later, as you get to know them better, to like them more and more. You could also use this expression when we're talking about a thing. You could start watching a television show, and at first you don't like it. But later you watch more and more episodes of the show, and it starts to grow on you. You start to like it more and more as you get to know it better and better over a period of time. The second expression, his bark is worse than his bite, refers to a dog. The verb to bark, B-A-R-K, means to make a short, loud sound. It's the specific verb we use to describe the way a dog makes a sound. To bark can also mean to shout or say something in a loud and angry way. Don't bark at me means don't yell at me in a loud and angry way. When we're talking about a dog, it's simply the sound that a dog makes when the dog is angry or, I guess, wants attention. I don't know. I don't have a dog, but that's what I understand. My family had a dog when I was growing up, but he didn't like me very much, probably because I didn't like him very much. Anyway, the other verb in this expression you need to understand is to bite, B-I-T-E. To bite, B-I-T-E, refers to the action using your teeth when you eat, or perhaps simply when you open your mouth and close it on some object. If you make a dog angry, the dog may bite you, may open his mouth and put his teeth into your leg or arm. The expression then, his bark, here using bark as a noun, is worse than his bite, again, same thing, using bite as a noun, means that he may make a lot of noise, but he isn't going to hurt you. This could refer to a dog, but it's usually used to refer to a person who may get angry and yell, but isn't really a bad person or won't actually hurt you. Our final question comes from Christina, C-H-R-I-S-T-I-N-A, from countries unknown. Maybe she's from several countries, you don't know. Christina wants to know why we would use the expression script by Lucy Say and not scripted, S-C-R-I-P-T-E-D, by Lucy Say. You may see this, for example, on our learning guides, Script by Dr. Lucy Say. Script by Dr. Lucy Say means this script was written by Dr. Lucy Say. If you use the form of scripted, there's a slight difference, or could be a slight difference in meaning. We usually use the word scripted with the ED at the end to refer to remarks or comments that someone makes that are written out beforehand and then read. For example, if the President of the United States were talking to journalists, members of the media, he might have certain remarks, certain things he wants to say that are already written down on a piece of paper. We would say that his remarks or his comments are scripted. Usually they're scripted by someone who works in the White House. The opposite of that would be for him to give remarks that are unscripted, or that are, to use a more technical word, extemporaneous, extemporaneous. If your remarks are extemporaneous, you have not prepared them in advance. You haven't scripted them out first. They haven't been scripted by anyone. When I record the English Cafe, most of what I say is not scripted by anyone, although I do have a script that gives me information that I then summarize and comment on. If you have a question or comment, you can email us. Our email address is ESLPOD@ESLPOD.com. From Los Angeles, California, I'm Jeff McQuillan. Thank you for listening. Come back and listen to us again right here on The English Cafe.
ESL Podcast English Cafe was written and produced by Dr. Jeff McQuillan and Dr. Lucy Say. This podcast is copyright 2015 by the Center for Educational Development.